everyone. It's 7 a.m. here in New York City, and you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, What's Going On with Bob Henley.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBI's Morning Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? Michael T. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. It's just after 7 a.m., August 29th. This is your Monday Morning Drive Time Labor and Social Justice Report. Sunrise was at 6:20 a.m. It's 75 degrees under cloudy skies in New York City. It'll brighten up today as we head back into the mid-80s. The rest of the week, we'll be in the same temperature range with no rain in sight for the next several days. We're down several inches of rain this month, and water restrictions of varying severity are in place. This widespread rain deficit has created extraordinarily dry conditions throughout the region, with firefighters from Ulster and Orange County spending much of their weekend up in the Hudson Valley fighting brush fires. According to the New York Times, both New York and New Jersey have seen a 20% drop in new COVID cases, outpacing the U.S. as a whole in the decline by several percentage points. There's been a decline in monkeypox cases as well, and federal public officials are, quote, cautiously optimistic, citing rising vaccination rates and changes in sexual behavior. Meanwhile, on the polio front, officials report the number of counties that have detected the potentially crippling virus in their wastewater has grown to include Sullivan County, in addition to Rockland and Orange counties, as well as New York City. This indicates we are seeing increasing community-based transmissions of this disease that the U.S. largely eliminated in the late 70s after a widespread vaccination campaign. Over the weekend, New Jersey officials closed a portion of a hiking trail in Sussex County because of a die-off of more than 100 black vultures who contracted avian bird flu. And the state says it doesn't have, ready for this, the sufficient trained staff to go into the rough terrain and properly dispose the infected birds that have a 5-foot wingspan. You know the ones I'm talking about. I did a story on this for Insider NJ yesterday, and thanks to Bill Wolf, former DEP official, and Jeff Tittle, the troublemaker formerly with the Sierra Club, I got a real eye-opener report on just how crazy this is and that it risks further exposure to other birds. It's all a lot, but this is the real world that you first responders and other frontline essential workers are working and living in. This morning, we'll talk with Uniform Firefighter Association President Andy Ansbro and get an update on the ongoing fallout from former Mayor Bill de Blasio's coercive COVID vaccine policy. We'll catch up with Delvaney Powell, President of the United Probation Officers Association, about what it's like for the members, for her members who work to provide New Yorkers an alternative to incarceration and make tens of thousands of dollars less than other law enforcement officers. Would it surprise you to find out that most of the people in this probation officer's title are college-educated women of color? No, not my listeners. You know what the 411 is. Then we'll finish up with a segment on the ongoing fight for basic labor rights being fought on the South by call center workers working with CWA, who are targeting Maximus, a federal contractor that gets billions of dollars of your taxpayer funds to handle, ready for this, customer service calls for agencies like Medicare, but pay so little that workers can't afford health care. More scarcity. And, of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Trump has cost them the House in 2018. He cost them the Senate in 2020. The House is likely to flip, but he very well could cost them a very winnable Senate majority, too.
Cook Political Report editor Jessica Taylor says the chance of a red wave in November is shrinking as former President Donald Trump's chosen candidates create fractures in the GOP. With the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the January 6th congressional hearings, the generic congressional ballot is all but tied. Cook's outlook for the House had been a GOP gain of 20 to 30 seats, but that's now 10 to 20 seats. In the Senate, the parties appear tied with eight toss-up races. A little more than 2 months until Election Day, political analyst Bill Kristol notes President Joe Biden's approval is up slightly at about 42%. He says an unpopular president is a drag on his party.
On the other hand, voters are also capable of saying, not crazy about Biden, but let's look at the two parties that are competing for control of the Senate and the House and what their agendas are and what their leadership is. And Trump is now as much on the ballot as Biden.
Meanwhile, an Axios poll found about 60% of Republicans want Trump as their nominee in 2024. Politico reporter Andrew Desiderio says Trump is using the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago to his advantage.
That's why he was the one to make public the FBI search in the first place, right? Because he believed, and I think correctly, that this actually helps him with his base of voters.
On Friday, the Justice Department unsealed a heavily redacted search affidavit, which showed the boxes seized included confidential, secret, and top secret documents. Intelligence agencies say they are studying possible damage to national security. President Biden was asked about Trump's assertion that the documents were declassified.
I've declassified everything in the world. I'm president. I can do it all. Come on.
A federal judge is expected to appoint a special master to independently oversee a review of the material per a request from Trump's team. Some in the GOP say they're looking at suing the Biden administration over student loan forgiveness. Biden wants to erase up to $10,000 in debt for those meeting income requirements, $20,000 for Pell Grant recipients. Critics say that's unfair and doesn't fix the larger problem of skyrocketing college tuition. Biden is using the 2003 HEROES Act, which gives the education secretary power to give students debt relief during a crisis. Deputy Director of the National Economic Council, Bharat Ramamurthy, says the White House will defend the plan in court.
The president was clear from the beginning that he did not want to move forward on this unless it was clear that it was legally available to him.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks, Mary Sherman. Without further ado, I want to get to my first guest, Andy Ansbro, who was the president of the Uniformed Firefighters Association. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Listen, we do have to do a little setup here because we've been in contact about this COVID right on through the over 2 years we've been dealing with it. So what I remember was that in the de Blasio administration, months before the vaccine even came into existence, the Municipal Labor Committee, under the leadership of Harry Nispoli, reached out, sent certified letters in an attempt to get Mayor de Blasio to the table to legally and properly negotiate the terms and conditions of meeting this challenge. The mayor did not do that and cynically played off each union off against each other. And I just wanted to preface this. I am pro-vaccine. I got vaccinated and boosted. I know you did, too. I know that throughout this, you set up an independent channel of scientific verification with your sources. But what the union is standing up for is the very important principle of the state being able to coerce mandatory vaccination without going through what people have fought and died for in terms of collective bargaining. Did I get that right, Andy?
Yes, you did, with the exception of I haven't been boosted. I did get the vaccine the first day I could.
Right. So give us a sense now. We have a new mayor. There were different, as so often is the case with Mayor Adams, there's something in what he says for everybody. And so it's hard to exactly know where he is. Where are we now? We know that it was the teachers got dealt with first. They had a longer launch time. And some agencies, as you say, seem to be more proactive in getting out the forms that permitted people to apply for religious and medical exemptions. You guys, however, apparently got jammed up. Take us back to that and remind people how it went down.
Right. When de Blasio announced the vaccine mandate, it originally applied to the teachers and the nurses, and that was announced in the summer of last year. As time went into the fall, he announced it for the rest of the municipal employees. And the speed at which the announcement came until everyone had to have their paperwork in and the deadline was, I believe it was announced October 20th. And people had to have their reasonable accommodation paperwork in within 6 days. And then 5 days after that, you had to have your shot or you were placed on leave if you didn't have the paperwork in. Every union that was still available scrambled to get a negotiation session in with the Office of Labor Relations. And when the UFA and the UFOA sat down for negotiations, when we left the table, there was 1 hour within which our members could get their reasonable accommodation paperwork in or miss the deadline. And obviously about 1,000 people missed the deadline. So 5 days later, they were put out of work because they didn't have the paperwork in on time. And as you know, New York City Fire Department was put into chaos on the day of the mandate, the deadline, as about 1,000 members decided not to put paperwork in at all, and they were sent home. There was 2,000 firefighters out of work on that day, and firehouses were running short-staffed, and they had to change the response matrix. It's important to note that in their original mandate paperwork, New York City said that there would be they expected all of the RAs to be completed within 25 days. So November 25th, they expected everything to be done. Here we are, late August of the next year, more than 10 months after the mandate started, 9 months after the deadline, and there are still firefighters that haven't had their accommodations totally completed, and they've been out of work for 9 months. So the city had told everyone they had 25 days, they'd have this whole thing wrapped up, and there are people out of work for 10 months. They obviously failed in their own guidelines and getting everything done.
I wanted to say, just from perspective, I just wanted to point out that that's roughly like if we talk about 10,000 active duty firefighters, you're talking about messing with over 10% of a force that was already kind of tight, right? So give people the context of this. And also, it's important that if people want to exercise the legitimate right to retire, the complication here is whether if you were married, if you're still are married or divorced, as a reality, you need to get a sign off on your pension. Again, give me some of that detail there, because it really gives people a sense of how impossible a mandate this was in the case of the UFA.
Well, yes, we had in the end, several hundred firefighters chose early retirement. I would say early, they chose to end their careers earlier than they would have. Because when their reasonable accommodation came up as denied, they decided that they were just done and they left. There were other members at the time. In that very short period, they made their decision to just leave. A couple of dozen members, just when their denial came in, they were terminated. About 20 people were terminated and they lost everything because they refused to submit to a vaccine they felt they didn't need.
Now, throughout this, you've been making the case that there is science that supports the idea that natural immunity, because it's important to know this population, along with EMTs, police, and we do know that several hundred civil servants died from COVID. Most of this happened before there was a vaccine. You lost firefighters. The biggest hit was an FDNY EMT, which is logical. We saw dozens in the police department. We saw people, I know of one very sad case, talking with Mr. DiGiacomo from the Detectives Endowment Association, where detectives going into the homes initially, when the whole focus was on the hospitals, people I was talking to, first responders, were saying, hey, listen, this is people are dropping dead in their homes. He had a detective that I ended up exposing his young family. Children got sick, wife got sick, and he died. This is nothing to mess around with. But can you talk about what principles are at stake here into the future? This is not just reactionary folks who are like militia-oriented survivalists that hate the state. This is about the principle of collective bargaining. Can you make that real for people who may be younger and don't understand what's at stake?
Absolutely. Over the decades, unions have fought to have the right to collectively bargain. There is a discipline process, and the vaccine mandate was written in such a way to totally go around that process. De Blasio knew probably well before the summer of 2021 that he was going to enforce this mandate, and he did not have cooperative dialogue with all of the unions as far as the implementation. And then after settling with the teachers on their mandate prior to September, he 2 months later just springs it on everyone else with a 10-day deadline. There was absolutely no reason not to do that, not to sit down and speak with everyone, but it was all part of his plan. Part of the mandate was that if a member did not comply and they did not have their paperwork in on time, they were placed on leave without pay, involuntary leave without pay. Now, in the discipline process, we have what is known as a suspension, and there was no reason he couldn't have suspended people and called this an order and went through the regular discipline process, but he chose not to. He chose this new leave without pay, totally outside of the collective bargaining. And the irony is, they said in their paperwork that everything would be completed within 25 days. All the appeals, the denials, and everyone would have their proper reasonable accommodation vetted in a legal manner, and that just never happened. Whereas if they had been suspended after 30 days, they would have been allowed to come back to work. Now, the other irony is that everyone that put in a reasonable accommodation, it took them months and months to start going to complete going through them. And here we are 10 months later, and they haven't gone through them all, and people have been out of work. Although at this point in time, the number is rather small because they've whittled it down this much. But people have been out of work for 10 months because their paperwork did not make the 5 or 6 day deadline. And at the same time, people that did make the deadline have been working, and they still haven't received the shot. So there's no difference. The only difference between being out of work or in work was making a deadline in late October within days of this mandate being placed on everybody. And now people are out of work and have missed 9.5 to 10 months out of paychecks over something that should have been completed on November 25th. The paperwork was also done by November 25th by the city.
I wanted to throw out the number, listeners, 212-209-2877. You're our stockholders, as you know, 212-209-2877. Andy, I also want to say, around that time, I interviewed Sarah Nelson, who is the president of CWA flight attendants, 50,000 flight attendants, 17 different carriers. These are largely women, folks that are in the process of dealing with maybe having a family, whatever. There's a whole host of issues and complications. And she was working with a cooperative model where the union sat down with United. They went through all the things because there are really contraindications for the vaccine for certain people. It's very small, but there is that universe. So they developed a process where all of the there was a way that you could opt out. You had information given to you ahead of it, and there wasn't the same conflict. Now, I would say that you might note that Mayor de Blasio, all through this period, was getting on Morning Joe as the lead, trying to race Cuomo for the alpha male fighting the pandemic. And the thing I think is most unforgivable is he would constantly say, Bill de Blasio is in the public interest. The unions, well, they fight amongst themselves, and they're really about interests of their members, which really flies in the face of what unionism is about.
Absolutely. And if anyone thinks that de Blasio's timing wasn't politically motivated, the mandate went into effect for most city employees the day before the primaries. You know, you can't have any more politically motivated than that. He was trying to steal the press from primary day by putting his mandate, not the primary, the general election, by having his mandate begin the day before the generals.
Well, now, so let's just turn a bit, and I thought we'd be remiss. We did talk with Terry Ariola of the city council, who is on fire and emergency service. She chairs that. She's been looking at the Twin Parks fire up in the Bronx. You gave me some great insights. Can you talk about what was at work there, and that at one time we used to have a fifth firefighter, and through the years of cutbacks, it's been cut down to only a few units have that. And can you talk about what role that plays on the ground? Because I don't think this is kind of inside baseball, but it's important, especially if you're someone that's living in high density housing that's not properly maintained.
Right. Well, it's no shock that firefighting is a labor intensive operation. When you see a fire truck rolling down the street, if it has a ladder on the back of it, that's called a ladder. And or a truck, that fire apparatus has an officer and five firefighters. If you see an engine has the hose on the back of it, that is called an engine, and it's got an officer and four firefighters. There was a time every one of them in the New York City had five firefighters. Some of them in the busy areas had six. Over time, that's been whittled down. In the 80s, when there was a budget crisis, they dropped the staffing from an officer and five to an officer and four firefighters. And studies done at the time have shown that having that extra firefighter could get water on a fire in half the time, because moving the hose around from the rig to the fire floor takes a lot of time. So the union fought with the city to bring back the fifth firefighter, and in the mid-90s, they agreed to bring back a third of the staffing to the, at the time, about 200 engines. Now we're down to 193. So this went on for about 15 years, and then Mike Bloomberg ended broke the agreement. It let it sunset. And every
I'm so surprised.
Again, with a budget crisis, let's cut firefighters on rigs. And they cut it down to four firefighters in every engine company in the city. In two contracts ago, we negotiated to bring back 20 of them. So as it stands now, 10% of the engine companies in New York City have an additional firefighter, and it speeds up the amount of time it takes. It decreases the amount of time it takes to get water on the fire. Now, part of the agreement that was had in the past, and this recent agreement, was that if medical leave would reach a certain number, a certain percentage, 7.5%, that they would be allowed to take that firefighter off the engine company to save money for overtime.
I want to zero in. First of all, we have two things. We have a call in the line there, our stockholder, but I just want to point out that those things really should have nothing to do with each other. Fire safety in the city of New York, particularly in a high-rise environment, that's an extraneous matter. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Hey, good morning. This is TK. I'm calling from the hot polio land of Rockland County. Statistics are important to me. And right now, we don't have any numbers on the amount of people that caught COVID from the police officers that arrested them, that they had altercations with. We don't know how many people caught COVID when they called the ambulance because they was having a heart attack, a stroke, or whatever, and they caught COVID because they didn't want to get shots. Nor do we know how many children caught it from teachers, how many people caught it locked up with these
Yeah,
for callers. I got this on my
mind. Yeah, I know. You seemed exasperated. That's why.
These union people, they do good, yes. but they do bad too. And they only are concerned about their memberships, which is fine. But when you have a public facing position, you should also be concerned for the public. And that's where it's a problem with the situation. So I want to hear about that.
I want to let the guest respond. Please call again. This is should be part of a much larger conversation. I'm going to have a segment just for callers coming up soon, because I would like to engage you all in a deep conversation. But before I go to Andy, I just want to point out that we do not have any kind of after action report on the occupational exposure for first responders around the country. The only window that I know of was something put out by the Guardian newspaper and Kaiser Health, which flagged in the first year, 3,600 healthcare workers died because of the occupational exposure. This country is afraid to ask that question. Andy, go ahead. You want to respond to the caller, and then we have to jump. Go ahead.
Sure. Now, as we all know, the mandate, the vaccine came out in December of 2020. We embraced the vaccine when it came out. My members, about half of them, wanted the vaccine initially, and they received the vaccine when they could. By that time, most of my members had already been infected. And as everyone was told when this pandemic started, that we were trying to get to a point of herd immunity where people had either gotten through the virus or been vaccinated. And once the vaccine came out, the concept of herd immunity went out the window, and they told us this was new. This was something different where everyone's got to get vaccinated. And the CDC has just gone back on that information. Their change of the decades or centuries old wisdom that once you're infected, you no longer need to get vaccinated. And they went back on that, and a lot of members were well aware of the hypocrisy. They had already been through the infection, and they did not feel the need to get vaccinated, and they were correct. And now you're asking how many people were infected by firefighters that refused to get vaccinated? I would say that answer is zero. When we go on calls, medical calls, we're wearing a proper PPE, and which decreases transmission. And there's a certain amount of time that you must spend with someone in order to have a transmission between them. And we fall outside those guidelines on all of our interactions. So I would say the answer is zero.
That's a straight
New York
direct
City firefighter of giving them COVID. On the other hand. When this pandemic came, there wasn't enough PPE to go around, and the majority of my members got it from doing their job.
Right. That's a very important point. Andy, how do people get in touch with you?
They could reach out through email. You're saying civilians?
Or anybody.
You can email me or call the office. We have our phone numbers online.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time, Andy. And I'd like to get an update in a couple of months on this issue. We cannot take our eye off the ball of this fundamental right of collective bargaining. Thanks so much for your leadership.
Thank you very much. We have some lawsuit updates that are coming. We are filing for a summary judgment in our RA case. The city failed to engage in cooperative dialogue, and they basically... they rushed through these RAs, and a judge has, although it hasn't ruled in the case, he has found we have demonstrated a likelihood of success on the merits, and we are hoping to take that case further and prove that New York City violated New York City, New York State human rights laws when they failed to engage in this dialogue with us to hear out members' religious and medical accommodations for the vaccine.
Thanks so much, Andy. We'll talk soon. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll be back with Vinnie Powell from the Probation Officers Association. That was Andy Ansbro, Uniform Firefighters Association. I am honored to be joined by Delvaney Powell with the United Probation Officers Association. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Very good. I first, by way of introduction, if you could explain to people what your folks do, what's the function they perform?
Okay, so I represent less than 700 probation officers as of today, who are predominantly female and persons of color. The job of a probation officer, the task of a probation officer, must I say, is the alternative to corrections. So when a person or doesn't get sentenced to corrections, a term in corrections, they get sentenced to a term to probation. They can get, and that's men, women, and youth. And they can get sentenced from 6 months to, kids can get 6 months to 24 months, and adults can get a split sentence where they spend some time in correctional facility at Rikers, and then the remaining of the time can be, it will be served at on probation. We can have people from adults three, five, ten, life on probation. It's an alternative to incarceration.
Wow. And so
yeah.
What do you have to do? What are the qualifications for this job?
You have to have a college degree, no less than 4 years college degree, and in some case, in master's degree with no experience. But with the bachelor's, you have to have some experience.
And so you also carry a sidearm. You have to receive weapons training and self-defense training. Is that right?
Yeah, we have 8 weeks of training in the academy, and they get the same training as other law enforcement, and we get self-defense training, self-defense tactics and training, firearm training, fundamentals. Yeah, they get the same exact training as other law enforcement because we're law enforcement.
So what, and this is the part that just knocked me back, and what's the starting salary for this dangerous frontline job that's about an alternative to incarceration?
Now, if you come in with no experience, right, and just a bachelor's, you start with $45,934, and then it goes up to $53,461.
Excuse me. Right? Okay, I hear it again. I knew it. Mm-hmm. You caught me by surprise. I'm gobsmacked. I do not understand that. Now, let's review, shall we, in terms of the risk threat matrix. You're in plain clothes, right? You're not uniform, right?
No.
Okay. And so you're civilians carrying a sidearm and trying to help people who have trouble with the law historically, some kind of issue, and you go in to try to make sure that they're being their best and highest self in their very difficult environments for the huge sum, and I'm being sardonic, of $45,000 and change if you haven't done the job before.
Yes. And that's it. And that's why we can't retain people, because the salaries are so low. And living in New York City is so expensive. These people, we can't live here. So we have to, they leave after a certain amount of time, and they go into other jobs where they know they're going to get a decent salary, because they can't make it.
So what's happening here is, you told me that at one point you were like at 820, something like that. That's the full complement that the budget calls for?
We was at, I don't know what the budget calls for, but I know in 2019, we was at 829. Now we're down to, last time I checked, the 671. As we speak, they turned in their equipment. So the numbers are going down. Even though I give the city credit, I'm not going to lie, the city has been doing, trying to hire more people. But it's like that cup in the hole in the bottom of the cup. No matter how much water you pour in there, you just can't seem to fill it up. And the reason you're not going to fill it up, because the salaries are not compatible to other law enforcement agencies within the city and outside the five boroughs.
So calls, if you'd like to get in on this conversation, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So, I know what this labor market looks like, Devaney, around the country. Mm-hmm. And if you are a college graduate, and you've managed to, you can use a firearm, and you've got self-defense training, and you're a person of color, I would imagine that there are thousands of jurisdictions in other places that would love to have you come work in law enforcement.
Absolutely. Get the New York, look, Bob, you get the New York experience, you become a gold mine. And then you go, you take all that training that we've had and experience, New York experience, and you take it someplace else.
Well, and that's what we don't want. So just reminding listeners that we are, you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM. It's your Monday morning, What's Going On, a labor report. So the other thing that you educated me on was that you guys are out of phase in terms of contract. Like your last contract, when did it lapse?
Excuse me?
When did your last contract lapse? Like you're out of phase.
Yeah, our contract ended in November 2020. And now we're ready to go back to the table and start negotiating as soon as possible.
And so you're dealing with the issue of inflation, fuel, all of that, and also trying to, with this inferior salary in a competitive private job market. That seems like a it seems like what I don't get is I know that there's a consensus in Albany and in City Hall that says and does press conferences about we must have alternatives to incarceration. And yet what you're telling me is we're nickel and diming the people that can make this work.
Absolutely. That's right. You're talking about alternatives to incarceration, and we're here. It's like we're saying, hello. We've been here since, 1800, and John Augustus, the father of probation, created probation. We've been here in your face. But like you said, they're nickel and diming us, and instead of utilizing us the way you should be and compensating us the way they should be, it's just not happening. Because we're here. We're doing it. We had a assembly a couple of weeks ago, a celebration of probation week. And our commissioner was talking about statistics, and she was saying that out of 9 out of 10 people successfully complete probation, but you don't hear that. We give people early discharges, like 1 out of 5 might get an early discharge out of probation. Probation is, like I said, not only we are the alternative to corrections, but we are giving you a second chance. We give people, men, women, and children, once again, a second chance at life. We give you the gift of an option, right? So we engage our probation clients and helping them change their lives, right? But we don't. It's not like we telling you what to do. We engage them. We get them. We have them participate in the whole process. And I tell you, with the shortage of offices that we have, I have to commend my members because they've been holding New York City down and keeping it safe. Even during the pandemic, we were ordered by the former deputy mayor to supervise people who was in corrections because of the concern about the increase of the COVID virus. So what they did was they pulled people from out of Rikers and we put them on the electronic monitoring. And my members worked along with corrections and they monitored those people during that time. They've been doing an amazing work. Yes.
And it sounds like you helped the city when, of course, the city needed it most. I do remember I saw you because you give some powerful testimony at the city council. I've heard you, and you have a bit of preacher in you. But you always were paired with Orrin Barzilay, Vinnie Varielli, because Local 2507, DC37, representing EMTs and paramedics and fire inspectors, Local 3621, representing fire EMS officers, are fighting a similar struggle because they make such a pittance compared to people they work with alongside each other at fire scenes by tens of thousands of dollars on the fire side. You both are taking a similar path. Talk about the court case. I understand you're laying a marker down here. Give us some background on the lawsuit so we can start to follow it.
So what happened was when I became the president, I was trying to figure out why can't we reach our top salaries. So I started looking at the salaries and the years people was on a job. And I realized when you have something called step monies and longevities, and when you add it all up and based on the starting salary, the starting salary, we was never going to reach that top salary. So I was fortunate to meet with one of my mentors, Alex Arthur Chilionis, and he told me about this case, this EEO case. Because every time I ask people about it, it was, nobody cares. No, you can't sue because you can't compare New York to the outside counties. Anyway, thanks to Mr. Chilionis, I was introduced to our current attorney, the Kirkland Group, and kind of find out that we had a case. And so now we're also suing the city for pay disparity. And let me tell you, every stage, there's something new coming out of this. I mean, I didn't believe it was going to be so astronomical, and it's really – It's a sad reality, what we're facing, a very sad reality.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, where you're calling from, what's on your mind, and what's your name?
Hi, this is Lucille. And so there's this journalist, I'm sure you've heard of him, Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L.
Yes, ma'am.
He's a journalist. Okay, so he told me, he said when he was 16, he left home, and the jobs that he got were menial, so they would pay maybe $2 an hour. This was way, way back when. So you were paid what you were worth. You work at McDonald's, they pay you $5 to flip burgers. Okay, so he wrote this article called Union Mob Rule. And I can't expound because I don't have enough time, but you can look it up. Union Mob Rule. So what's my point? This sister is saying that you go to school, you get 4 years of college, that would put you on a pedestal of someone making a decent salary, you would think, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Most places want you even to have a master's and all this kind of thing. Yeah. The higher you go, the better. And all this kind of thing. This is what they pump in us in this country. Mm-hmm. Get, you know, make the grade and you'll get the cash. But she's proven that that's a bunch of bullshit. She's proving that. Not only that, I want to know what's her opinion, because you got a lot of dirty cops out here. Filthy, dirty precincts. They're in with these hoodlums, and don't think the people don't know it.
Well, let me get to the caller, because we're up against the end of the segment. Thanks for calling again. Go ahead. So what's your response to the caller?
She's right about you go to school, and we push our kids, right, go to school, get education so you can live a decent life. And we went to school. We got an education. Some of us are still paying student loans, and we can't get that American dream. We're still trying to reach that American dream, and it's very sad to how we. Let me tell you something. We probation is about changing lives, right, and helping people get on the right path. We're so good at what we do that our probation clients end up making more money than us, which is a good thing, but it's kind of crazy too. They go on to be political figures and stars and business owners and all these wonderful things, and yet we still struggling trying to get to.
Well, I have a great idea. A full page ad in the New York Times with you and some of your graduates. What do you think?
I would love that.
All right. That's just how we get it done. How can people get in touch to help you with your struggle?
Excuse me? Oh, people, they can reach out to unitedprobation@gmail.com. Which is open. People can come and they can send comments to that email, and they can also contact me at dalvany@upoa.com.
Well, you call me 24/7. If we can be of help, we got your back.
I appreciate you, and I thank you again for this opportunity for us to tell our story.
Right, Dr. Bonnie Powell, United Probation Officers Association. We'll be back with Tanya Jackson to talk about the struggle down south with Maximus, the federal contractor that takes billions of your tax dollars and underpays the people that work for them. So surprised.
A long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. What's up there beyond the sky? It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. That is just gives me good energy to move forward. I'm pleased to be joined online by Tanya Jackson, who has been involved with the struggle down south dealing with this Maximus company that takes billions of dollars of your taxpayer money and then provides the service for answering your questions about Medicare and many other federal programs. Good morning, Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. How are you all doing this morning?
Well, really good, now that we got a hold of you. So give us some background. Okay. Where do you work, and what's the situation? What's the 411 down in Maximus?
Okay, so as you said, my name is Tanya Jackson, and I work at Maximus as a customer service rep. which is basically one of the largest federal contracts of the federal government. We help people with Medicare and Affordable Care Act, or as they call it, Obamacare, enroll in their coverage and answer claims questions as well.
So and so what does this pay?
About their insurances.
Right.
Okay. When we first started off, we were making $9.05. That was 6 years ago. That contract started in Mississippi in 2012. So every time they would ask for a raise or anything, it was like, it'll take an act of Congress. It'll take an act of Congress. And once we started doing a collective bargaining, basically things started to change. So we went from 905 to 1065 to 1105 to where we're at now at $15.
Now, what does that, the reality though, is that $15 an hour, if you're, it's not a family supporting wage. And so what I've, in the CWA material that I've been reading and following this for a while, what you have is people answering, primarily women, people of color, answering these calls for people about right. health care that they can't often afford.
Exactly. Because we can't afford our you know, insurance. We started off 2022 and said, oh, this is the best plan for you all. We reached this decision. Well, we had a deductible of $4,000.
Hmm.
People with families, that deductible was $6,500. It was very expensive.
And we call that catastrophic health care. That's what a catastrophic health care.
Right. And a lot of people couldn't get basic. We had one worker. They denied her pacemaker.
Hmm.
Said it wasn't medically necessary. So that's the kind of insurance we're dealing with. When we're sitting here helping millions of Americans get insurance and answer questions about the complex questions about their insurance, when we can't even get decent insurance ourselves.
Mm. And tell me about the occupational stresses. I mean, I'm a Medicare member, Medicare person over 65. From time to time, I've had to call in. What's it like? I mean, we know that there's been workplace violence, something we've covered extensively here on the program, but call centers aren't immune from abuse. Can you talk about what you're hearing from the American people as you try to help them navigate these very complicated bureaucracies?
Well, it's very complicated, especially in, for example, I work primarily, I'm Medicare. So we have people basically, millions of Americans that don't know, okay, why do I have a late enrollment penalty for my drug plan? Well, it's not told to people when they sign up for Medicare. Medicare requires you to have a drug plan, whether you know it or not. So, you know, they don't get the brunt of that. I mean, they come to us arguing, you know, we get all of that when claims are not paid and filed correctly by doctors. The doctors doesn't hear it. We hear it. If something is not going right, you know, it's us. So those calls can get very complex. People that don't know about what insurance they need to have, what doctors they can go to, especially when they sign up for these Advantage plans that you have these agents signing people up without their knowledge. And these people can't get chemo care and other care because they've been signed up without their knowledge. Or they were told this plan works for them when it don't. But we get the brunt of that. Basically anything that goes wrong when their premiums are not right. They don't call Social Security. They call Medicare. Where Social Security, IRS, all these people make twice as much as we make. But they don't get to answer these questions because everything is referred to us at Medicare. And we have to answer these people questions that we don't have answers to.
Well, what I wanted to say is, don't you think that because the stakes are so high, these are life and death issues here, shouldn't this be part of the civil service? Isn't the government getting off cheap here? And shouldn't people have the job security and dignity that would come with civil service. It seems like a government job.
Right, exactly. And it should be. Because like I say, most of the questions that have to be asked, everybody gets referred to Medicare. They're not sure about the doctor. They call billing at their providers, hospitals. Hospitals tell them to call Medicare. Nobody answers these questions. Suppliers. We have people that need oxygen. You have these suppliers that don't want to bring out equipment and supplies or replace, like the big thing with the CPAP machine.
Wow.
They have Medicare. Yeah.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind? And what's your name?
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Mercedes calling from Brooklyn. I walked into a house in Central America, Costa Rica, and heard my friend's daughter enrolling people down there. So that's something you may want to look at, that outsourcing, because one U.S. dollar is 670 of their currency. So I guess it's cheaper to pay someone down there to enroll people in these plans. So maybe you need to take a look at that and see, you know, if that's one of the reasons why you can't earn anything.
Oh, that is so brilliant, Mercedes. We will follow up on that. Thank you so much for calling. Is that on your radar, Tanya?
It's on ours because what we do is the same exact thing because we can enroll people in plans. And I know people, well, lady I know, and she told me, she said, well, she said, you all need to look into that. She said, because I sell those Advantage plans. And they're probably making good money, especially if she's in Costa Rica, because the people in America, those agents, she said she gets paid $573 per person that she enrolls into a Medicare Advantage plan or prescription drug plan.
So it seems
we see none of that money.
Right, exactly. And so what I'm wondering is, the CWA, so how has the CWA been helping you all?
Okay, so the CWA, they've been helping us tremendously. What they've been doing is filing, you know, we've been doing petitions. We've been striking. That's the biggest thing we've started doing. And we've been looking into a lot of these things that primarily are just injustice to us.
Right.
So we've did three strikes in 2022. One time we did it for the health care deductible, I stated that was high. We did it for the wages as basic eliminating our prescription drug plan. A lot of our employees can't even afford their prescriptions or even go to the doctor. So, the last one was a big pretty big because, like I say, Maximus, the contracts we have, they have over, I think, nine different sites. They have them in Florida, Texas, Utah, Kentucky, and Mississippi, as well as Louisiana.
That might be some right-to-work states.
Yes, exactly.
Listen, how can we support? We're very big on taking action. How can we support your struggle?
Okay, so you can support our struggle. We have a solidarity fund that you all can contribute to and help support. Sign those. We also have, like, petitions on there as well that you can sign. You can go to cwa.org/CCW. Solidarity Fund. And our motto is, when we move, they move, just like that. And we're just looking forward to until our union is won. We're going to keep trying.
We'd like to have you back on. Thank you so much. That's Tanya Jackson. She's working on the Maximus campaign with the CWA. That's it for us today, this morning. In this space tomorrow, Frenchie Davis, Democracy Now! Is up next. Coming forward to Labor Day will be our one-year anniversary. Can you believe that? It's really quite something. And as you can tell, I was making a list of all the people we've had on. It's just incredible. And You've provided that support. We need you to continue doing that and do what you can to support us. We need financial support. This doesn't happen magically. There aren't radio elves. It's us and it's you. We need you to please do all you can. And of course, if you become a BIA buddy, you'll get Stuck Nation, the book that kind of laid all this out, well, a year ago. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Democracy Now! Is up next. Remember, we get the world we fight for.
Union City Blue. WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Every Monday at 7 a.m., we bring this kind of information to you, talking about unions, union leadership, union membership, most importantly, union membership, with Bob Henley leading us through this kind of a minefield, trying to look at all of the issues that working people, you and me, are dealing with. So Bob Henley starts things off on Mondays with what's going on. Tuesdays, Frenchie Davis will be here in the seat, so to speak, metaphorically speaking. Frenchie Davis will be here Wednesdays. Linda Sarsour will be chairing What's Going On. Felipe Luciano on Thursdays. And on Fridays, James Irsay will be with you. We are listener-sponsored and commercially free. And how you can support, Tanya Jackson said, let's give that address out once again. That's CWA.org/CCW Solidarity Fund. And if I got it wrong, Bob will get in touch with me and tell me that I got it wrong so we can get it right. But I think I wrote it down correctly. So that's CWA.org/CCW Solidarity Fund. And speaking of how you can support our struggle here at WBAI so that we can bring you this kind of information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as to become, as Bob said, become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Of course, you can pledge more than that, but for $10 a month, you can become a BAI buddy. Call our pledge line right now at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950 and say, I want to support the struggle of WBAI. It is important. It is in the center of the FM dial. It's been there for 62 years and counting, thanks to listeners just like you. And I want to support that effort. So that's why I'm calling this number right now. Can you do that in a hurry? I'm just about ready to run out of the house. I'm busy. I'm doing other things. So please, can you hurry? Call 212-209-2950 and say, I want to become a BAI buddy. You can do it. Do it right now. Democracy Now! Is upcoming. Please stay tuned. Yeah,